Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Simon Phipps joins me. We're going to talk about OpenShift, the platform as a service that's free. How is it free? You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Simon Phipps. Episode 211, recorded May 16th, 2012. OpenShift.
Brought to you by Ford, giving customers the power of choice with a full line of electric and hybrid electric vehicles. Learn more about Ford electric vehicle technologies at Ford.com/technology.
It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, with a slightly gravelly voice today. So I hope you guys can all put up with that a little bit, because I've been chatting all weekend and somehow my throat just got completely ruined. But speaking of throats, no, that doesn't even sound like a good transition at all, but I'm usually joined by a wonderful co-host for this show. And again, no different this week. We're got wonderful welcome back again, Simon Phipps.
Thank you very much, Randall. You said your gravelly voice sounds very gravelly, I have to say. And I'm sitting here in San Jose, California, because I was speaking at an event last night. So you see the light flooding in an unfamiliar way in the background there, instead of me being in my dark, night-filled cabin in the UK.
Well, I'm glad you could take time out of your busy schedule to co-host today, because we have a really interesting guest today. Not that we don't have interesting guests other weeks, but we have a great guest today. Mark Atwood, one of the employees of Red Hat, is going to join us to talk about OpenShift. OpenShift is a platform as a service providing software. Let's see if I can make a sentence out of this. Okay, so it's a service. It's a bunch of software that provides platform as a service. And what platform as a service means is that they provide sort of the whole stack. So not just the infrastructure like a bare Linux machine, but like also including like an Apache install, maybe a MySQL install, so like the full LAMP stack. And I've been really excited about what I've been reading about in terms of doing the research for the show this morning. Simon, did you get a chance to look over some of the materials about this?
Yeah, it all looks pretty interesting. It looks like it's the app that cloud has been waiting for to make it simple to do. So I'm going to be interested to look at it. And it's be good to talk to Mark again as well. He's done everything. He's been involved in MySQL. He's been involved at Eucalyptus. He was a colleague at Sun when I was there. So he's got a lot of experience in open source himself as well. It's going to be interesting to talk to him about both his work and about himself.
Very good. And I know a very important question I'm going to ask, as I've been asking it sort of in the closing of the show the last 4 or 5 weeks, this is free. So how in the world is Red Hat going to make money by giving away a free hosting service? I do not understand this. So we'll definitely have to ask Mark that when we bring him on. So, but before we do that, we have a very important announcement from none other than Leo Laporte himself. Let's hear from Leo.
Hey, thanks a lot. I want to talk to you a little bit before we get back to Floss Weekly about Ford and their electric vehicles. I get to do this because I am a Ford driver. I actually have a friend who says, we're a Ford family. They have several Ford vehicles, but I am excited as heck. As you probably know about the new Ford Electric, the Ford Focus Electric for 2012, which is now finally here. If you have a Ford EV certified dealer in your neck of the woods, you can go over and drive one. And let me tell you, it's interesting. Ford didn't rush. They wanted to do it right, and they have. This is the electric vehicle to take a look at. Of course, all the benefits of electric. It's 100% electric, no zero CO or CO2 emissions. Lithium ion battery, which means you can top off without reducing the lifespan of the battery. But there's some real advantages to the Ford Focus Electric. It charges faster than any other vehicle out there. Fully charges in 3 to 4 hours if you have the 240-volt home charging station. You'll want to get that. You don't have to have it, but it's great if you have that. Those are the Leviton stations that you can get through your dealer. It has 110 MPGe, that's miles per gallon equivalent, which is the highest in its class. In fact, it is the most efficient 5-passenger vehicle in the entire country. I mean, it's amazing. And, of course, because it's Ford, they got the Ford Sync and the My Ford Touch, and they've really used the IT in the car and in your phone to take advantage of what's going on. For instance, your phone can manage the recharge process with the app. They will allow you to remotely control vehicle charge, preconditioning settings, monitor the battery state of charge. You can even, they have something called value charging, powered by Microsoft, which lets you reduce your electricity costs by charging the vehicle in off-peak hours or at reduced rates. And it's not complicated, very easy to do. You can access vehicle status, state of charge, current range from the smartphone app, program charge settings, download vehicle data from analysis right to your phone. And, of course, the My4 Touch has all sorts of additional features, including things like choosing the most eco-friendly route. You're just going to love this. I really want you to check out the 2012 Ford Focus Electric, available now at Ford dealers that are EV certified. And next year, the 2013 C-Max Energy plug-in hybrid. Now, this is really cool because it's got a gas engine, but you also plug it in. You use the batteries when you can. And if you have to, you can use the gas engine. It's kind of the best of both worlds. And 100 MPGe, so you're getting incredible fuel efficiency. Find out more. Go to Ford.com/technology and read up on this. They did it right. They waited, they planned, they thought, and they are going to have electric vehicles across the Ford line, plug-in hybrids across the Ford line. They're really paying attention to this because they want to give us the best eco-friendly vehicles ever. Thank you, Ford. Our planet thanks you. And now back to Floss Weekly.
And thank you, Leo, for that important message. And now let's go ahead and bring on our guest. So let's go ahead and bring on our guest. Welcome to the show, Mark Atwood.
Thank you, Randall.
And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm speaking to you from the Office Nomads Makerspace in Seattle, Washington.
Oh, wow. So Seattle, is it raining today? Because it almost always is raining, so...
That's what we tell people, but we have this weird light pouring down from this strange yellow ball in the sky. No one's quite sure what to make of it. Hopefully it'll go away.
Yeah, you know, I've seen enough of that being down here in Culver City for my work for the last year or so, and so it's been really amazing because, you know, I come from a place that's also very similarly raining, Portland, Oregon, so I can appreciate that as well. So enough about the travelogue part, so we'll get that out of the way for the show. I gave sort of a broad overview of OpenShift at the beginning of the show, but let's hear it right from the horse's mouth. Can you give us sort of the problem space that OpenShift is solving and how OpenShift solves it in 20,000 words or less?
20,000 words or less. So OpenShift is Red Hat's platform as a service. A platform as a service is the automation of 90% of the glue and the goo that's involved in building a web application. When you build a web application by hand, you have to set up a Linux machine, you have to put a web server on it, you have to choose your language, you have to put an application platform, you have to load all of your libraries, and you have to keep it all up to date. With a platform as a service, instead, you write the bits of code that make your application, you push it up to the platform as a service, sometimes abbreviated as a PaaS, and it takes care of all of the stuff that's common between 99% of all web applications.
So that would be things like having Apache installed and having some sort of database there and other things like that?
That's correct.
Okay, and so I, as a web developer, from time to time, spend a lot of time spinning up all this stuff from bare metal, essentially, or a simple virtual machine base install. So how do you decide what's in that next layer up that everyone has in common?
Well, everyone needs a web server, so we put Apache in there. Everyone needs a language runtime, whether it's PHP or Python or Java. We support the Java AS7 standard, EE6 on JBoss AS7. But everyone needs a language runtime. Everyone needs all the associated libraries. Everyone needs a database. So that's what we've decided to include. Part of awesome flexibility is the language runtimes themselves are very flexible. In the Python world, there's the Python package index. So in the case of OpenShift, you would just fill in a standard setup.py file, and we will pull all of the stuff out of the PyPy that you need. We do the same thing for PHP. We interface to Maven for Java applications. We interface to CPAN for Perl applications. So whatever you need in your language, we support for you because those language runtimes support it for you.
Now, are those all being pulled from the Red Hat standard repository then?
No, those are actually pulled out of the standard CPAN or PyPI. They don't have to be RPMized or anything to work on OpenShift.
Wow, so that's actually a step forward from some other systems I've seen like this. That's kind of especially get a complex. I mean, I can speak from the Perl perspective. I know that some of the CPAN modules have configuration parameters or have to be built interactively. How do you deal with that?
You know, you've just stumped me. I've not played much with the Perl one. I don't think we use the stock CPAN module, but use the CPAN module that can do the auto builds.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. Well, good. I'm glad I stumped you with something so early in the show. Wonderful. So getting back to the basics, for the first thing, I've been asking this like three or four times or for the last three or four shows. This is free. OpenShift, the basic service is free. How come and where's the money going to come from?
So we'd say it's in developer preview right now. So it's free because we want to get a workload and we want people to have some experience with how it works. It's not going to be free forever. We're Red Hat. We're a company that's in that we have to make money to stay in business. We are talking internally about the various charging models we'll have. We don't have prices locked down for it yet or anything like that. Our commitment is that what we're giving away for free right now, that level of service, that much Computronium, we will continue giving that much away. And if you want your application to scale larger than that or hold more data or more what we call gears, then you can pay us for that. We have also open sourced the product. It's called OpenShift Origin, and it's available on GitHub. And you'll be able to download that and run it yourself. And then also we're talking internally about exactly what our business model is there around that. It will probably, since we're Red Hat, will be the same business model that we're using already for Red Hat Enterprise Linux, where we give it away, but there are many opportunities to pay us to make it work better for you.
Right. So how does that work in terms of community? Do you have a community of people who are helping you create OpenShift, or does the community stop at the component parts that you're putting in the box?
We want to build a large and vibrant community. It's been open sourced for 2 weeks now, so it'll be interesting to see how the community develops. We've put basically everything that's in OpenShift into the open source repository. Much more is going to go in real soon, and then the only thing left will be the stuff that's really tightly integrated with Red Hat's billing and user account system. And then we've already given away instead more open systems to do that sort of thing, will interface to LDAP or that sort of thing. As far as to how open our community is, as I said, we open sourced it 2 weeks ago. We open sourced on a Monday, as I announced it. And then on Tuesday, we had pull requests on GitHub. On Wednesday, our internal engineers are reviewing those pull requests, and we merged them on Thursday. And that process is still ongoing. We're getting pull requests and branches from people outside of Red Hat. And our goal is to eventually have at least some of the core committers not be Red Hat employees, not have redhat.com email addresses.
Right. So you're using that GitHub model where you have a supreme decider that is accepting pull requests. Do you have any plan to have a community governance of any kind around OpenShift?
We do. We didn't want to define it very early because we weren't sure which way it would go. Our commitment is we're going to be as open as possible. The governance model is that right now we're the supreme dictator, but we don't want to have that forever. We're going to let the other people who are making commitments and people who are making patches make suggestions for what they want the governance model to be. The governance model is actually a page on our wiki, and anybody can sign up for that wiki and start making proposals to the governance model. As the project gets more complicated, we will probably need more governance than we have right now.
Right. So and you were talking about monetizing it at the beginning there. Do you think that you're going to end up trying to monetize OpenShift, the cloud service that Red Hat runs, and have OpenShift Origin as a purely open source project like Fedora? Or do you think it's likely that OpenShift Origin is going to be much more like RHEL in its basis and will therefore need forking so that we have an OpenShift CentOS or something?
It's been not been really solidly decided. I think the way it's going to work out is the OpenShift origin is going to be like Fedora. In fact, we're in the process right now of trying to get OpenShift origin into Fedora as an example of how independent the various projects are and how large Red Hat is. We can't just dictate that. It has to actually go through Fedora's own process. Once OpenShift origin is in Fedora, then it is likely that it will end up being very similar to RHEL in that there'll be a RHEL version of it. Again, that's something that hasn't been well decided. That is likely the way it's going to go, but we can't say yet exactly how it's going to happen.
Right. Okay. So now this sounds a lot like a lot of other things that I've been hearing about. So could you give us some kind of idea how this relates to things like Eucalyptus, Amazon Web Services, OpenStack? How does OpenShift position against those things?
So each of those things you named are all infrastructure as a service systems. OpenStack and Eucalyptus are both open source, and Amazon Web Services is a hosted service provided by AWS. But as infrastructure as a service, they give you very low-level stuff. You can design an image, you can spin up a virtual image, you can store raw objects, you can set up queues, that sort of thing. But you still have to write a whole bunch of glue and goo to actually stack an application on top of that. As Randall mentioned earlier, he stood up web applications before where he starts with the VM and has to put Apache and then his runtime and all that sort of stuff on it. You still have to do that stuff with infrastructure as a service. Platform as a service is a higher layer. Instead of having to start with the VM, you start with the ready-to-go language runtime. Is platform as a service works hand in glove with infrastructure as a service. In the case of the OpenShift hosted service, it's actually running on top of Amazon Web Services. And we've already demonstrated to people running OpenShift Origin on top of various microclouds running OpenStack. And the people at Eucalyptus are very interested in showing off running OpenShift on Eucalyptus, and that will probably show up real soon.
Right. So this is kind of an app that you put in a container that's run for you by a cloud infrastructure service. So the programming APIs you would write to are just vanilla programming APIs for the LAMP stack.
That's correct. That's actually one of the things we're very proud of with OpenShift is that we've added very, very little in the way of new APIs. The only new API it has is create an application, what applications am I running? And that's a RESTful interface that's very easy to discover and play with. All of the other APIs are completely standard. If your application will run on an ordinary LAMP stack, it'll run on OpenShift. It's very easy to pull an application out of OpenShift, stand up your own Apache server in your own runtime, and run your application in it. And if you have an application already in a standard LAMP setting, it's actually very easy to move it over to OpenShift. Right. Some of the other platform as a service systems, it's harder to migrate in and out of, but that's not the way we wanted OpenShift to work.
But one of the reasons that they're like that is because they're using custom APIs to constrain the function set that the application is using so that they can then scale and load balance it. Are you losing that ability to scale and load balance by sticking with a straightforward LAMP approach?
I don't think so. Scaling and load balancing are not the weird magic they were 10 years ago. We know how to scale file systems. We know how to run load balancers in front of web applications. So far, it hasn't been a problem for OpenShift. Completely standard modules and completely standard language runtimes have been demonstrated to scale massively in existing data centers, and we can do the same things on OpenShift.
Right, right. So, and how would you relate this to something like App Engine? From the sound of it, OpenShift is kind of in between App Engine as a very high-level app-specific API with the whole world hidden from you. Amazon Web Services is the metal that you're writing to and keeping screwed together. You sound like you're in between the two.
We're actually kind of at the same level of App Engine. App Engine does provide a lot more APIs than OpenShift does, so it appears to be at a higher level. But at the end of the day, what you use App Engine for is to just stand up a web application, write a little bit of web application code that designs your code, and then writes and defining definition files to link it up to App Engine's way of doing it. With OpenShift, you do the same thing, except the way you link to your application is exactly, and the way you define your application is exactly the same way you would do it if you're running your own LAMP stack.
Right. So this all sounds kind of interesting. You're using all open source in there. Do you think do you think that it all being open source delivers any software freedom to end users, or does the fact that this is a cloud service mean that the software freedom stops at the cloud like it does with pretty much everybody else?
It could stop just with the cloud and not, you know, make the and not to the users. But as I said, we have open sourced OpenShift Origin, and we would love to see people running a small cloud, a OpenShift Origin based cloud in their own data center or on their own infrastructure account. Or I actually have one running on my own laptop to develop against. So the fact that OpenShift Origin is open source gives people the same open source freedom that we've gotten so used to having over the last couple of decades.
Is this is OpenShift built around some of the things that we've interviewed previously on Floss Weekly? Or are you familiar with our previous shows about stuff we've talked about at Red Hat?
LibCloud and Aeolus. We've been working very closely with both LibCloud and Aeolus, and it doesn't use either of those projects yet, though I can see how that may happen in the future.
Because it started to sound like, you know, that this is sort of like the result of a lot of the other things we've talked with in the previous shows. So I was just curious.
They work very close. They're very similar. We're talking to each other. We're taking ideas from each other, and engineers from each of the projects have actually contributed code to each of the other projects. So while they're not dependent on each other yet, that may change in the future.
And so you mentioned OpenStack earlier. Does this so OpenStack is like the platform, or not the platform? OpenStack is like the infrastructure layer.
Yes.
Would this sit on OpenStack then?
Yeah. Is OpenShift would sit on top of OpenStack. Exactly the same way as right now the hosted service sits on top of AWS. We would love to see some of the large infrastructure providers who are spinning up OpenStack-based clouds provide OpenShift-based PaaSes. And you know, even if the infrastructure provider doesn't do it, an end user who needs PaaS flexibility for their own applications can get an account from an infrastructure provider running OpenStack, put OpenShift Origin on it, have their own PaaS to run their own applications on.
And back to scaling for a second, because that always fascinates me. I have small machines that I have for one of my clients where I'm now thinking about how I roll out, you know, multiple web servers and get high availability at that level. And obviously my main primary client, I think you might see if you're watching the video, also has that sort of issue, but on a much larger level. So how does OpenShift manage this sort of horizontal scaling?
Applications you write on OpenShift, they're supposed to be as stateless as possible. The shared state you should keep in a database or on the back end, and we have several databases that we provide to you. Postgres, MySQL, and MongoDB are the big three right now, and we're talking with other people to add cartridges for other database types. Scaling that back end is probably where we will bottleneck next, and we have work on that, and we're soliciting changes and patches from the community for people who have ideas for scaling that back end. As far as the application layer is, as your application load grows, as you start running out of memory, or as your network backlog starts to rise on any given application gear, OpenShift will spin that same application up on another gear and then attach it to the load balancer. So you can scale horizontally until you hit your gear limit.
Wow. And so it also means that, so basically, to put it in more concrete terms, I might have three machines running, you know, tens of each of Apache servers, pre-spawn servers, but all of them are going to ultimately talk to the same Postgres database then.
That's the idea. As I said, that's probably where we'll bottleneck next and where we're talking about ways of fixing that bottleneck. You and I have been both database guys for a while, so you understand the problems inherent in automatically scaling and sharding databases, and that's going to be an interesting problem to solve.
Absolutely. Although, if you have the right kind of database, like, say, I think at Mongo or some of the other non-SQL databases, it should be not too much trouble, right?
It would be less trouble, yes.
Yeah, definitely. So one other heavy technical question. I'm sure it's not past you, but so the load balancers can do things like session affinity, though, right?
They can. I haven't actually dug into our load balancer code. I think they're doing a session affinity, and if they don't, I suspect that's going to be a patch that'll come in real soon now.
So one of the things that I sort of was encouraged by was the idea that you're deploying this by pushing to a Git branch. Who came up with
yes.
that? And describe that process so people that have played with Git can follow along.
That's something we're particularly proud of. That was very early on in the original development of OpenShift. One of the cool things that means is that we don't have to give you the developer any additional tools and make any changes to your development process. A developer is supposed to make a change and then commit to Git and make a change and commit to Git. So what you do with OpenShift is you just add an additional remote to your Git repository that points at OpenShift instead of your own local Git repository. Mm-hmm. And then you push to that remote and your application pushes up to a Git server running on OpenShift. It takes your application or the changes to your application and then redeploys it. There's no special tooling. There's no special program to do that. In part, that means is that if you're using Eclipse and Eclipse has the Git plugins, then it works for you. If you're using Xcode, and I've seen people do this with Xcode with the Git plugin, then that will push to OpenShift. And if you're a command line guy like me, you just say Git push and then on the ID of the remote from your command line, and your application updates on OpenShift.
That's very cool. I have the same thing set up for my other clients' web services. That I just have a Git server running there, and if I push to master, it just stores it so that we can exchange commits to each other. But if I push it to the live branch, there's a special trigger there that recognizes, okay, go ahead and push this code into the Apache server and restart it if something needs to be restarted, and also push it to the other slave servers. So it's good that this has worked the same way. I was kind of surprised it was kind of cool that way.
It's something we're very proud of.
Yeah, very good. Describe some of the actual practical limitations of the model so far. Because you said we only have a limited number of gears. So describe sort of what scale I could probably get to without asking on that special email that you have in one of the pages about how much could I actually do with this in developer release so far?
The way I've been describing it is the gear gives you about as much as an Amazon M1 Tiny does. Depending on the of your application and your runtime and how heavy it is, you can support probably a couple of dozen to maybe a couple of hundred simultaneous connections. You get a couple of gigabytes of memory, a couple of 100 gigabytes of disk, and an appropriate amount of network bandwidth. It's enough for a small office application or a demo or a toy application. But if you want to scale to tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of users, you will need to start having it scale. And to do that, you need to contact us. We give you a new gear limit, or you have to wait until OpenShift leaves the developer preview and we start having paid gears that you can buy from us.
Cool. And what kind is it strictly for something like Apache, or could I also spin up a gear that was, say, running Nagios monitoring my other web servers?
Right now, it's web-based stuff. They sit behind Apache proxies. There are other kinds of cartridges, like, for example, ones that we have that spin up MySQL servers and Postgres servers. Now that OpenShift Origin is open source, that has demonstrated what our cartridge API is, and people are already working on writing cartridges for other things. A cartridge for Nagios is a great idea, and I just added it to my idea list. So if I don't get to it before someone else does.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So I'm interested to hear you using the word cartridge there quite a lot, Mark. What's that all about? What are cartridges?
A cartridge is kind of a defined chunk of functionality you can have OpenShift do. We have what we call language cartridges, and you pick one when you create your application, and the language cartridge says something like, I'm a Python application, or I'm a PHP application, or I'm a JBoss application. There are also cartridges that provide things like database services. Once you've started your application, you say, add the MySQL cartridge to my application. And that reaches inside OpenShift into a chunk of files and APIs. attaches it to your application. As another example of another kind of cartridge we actually have a PHP MyAdmin cartridge, which doesn't start up any daemons or services, but it makes PHP MyAdmin available to your application, and it attaches to both the web server and also to the MySQL server.
Right.
Is people will be able to write cartridges of any sort of cartridges they want now that we've shown have open sourced OpenShift Origin, and people can follow along in the template of other cartridges.
Right. So when I'm adding cartridges to an OpenShift instance, are they all running in the same instance, or am I actually spinning up separate virtual machines that then communicate using APIs?
It depends on the cartridge, actually. Some of the cartridges run in the same gear as the thing they're associated with, and some cartridges will want to start their own gears. As OpenShift Origin and OpenShift expand in features and functionality, we foresee eventually people saying, I want this cartridge to be in this gear, or I want this cartridge to have its own gear, or I want this cartridge to follow along with this other cartridge. And if that means they're in associated gears or in the same gear, OpenShift can deal with that. That's something that's still being worked on, how that will work. Right now, the cartridges, their own internal definitions describe whether or not they need their own gear or if they need to sit inside the same gear as some other piece of cartridge code.
Right. Now, I have some questions I have to ask you. Tell me about your licensing. How is the licensing working for all this stuff?
So we have licensed it with the Apache version 2 license. That's a BSD-type license without a reporting requirement. We picked that. It's because it's a well-known open-source license. Lawyers from a bunch of companies are already very comfortable with it. It is friendly both to individual developers and also to businesses. There is no need to fill out and send in a contributor agreement or any of that sort of stuff. That sort of thing is just built into the Apache license. That's the licensing we picked. There are other open source components that OpenShift uses. They use their own open source licenses, and we have to abide by those. But we, as much as possible, just use upstream code. So instead of making a change to some other open source project for the sake of OpenShift, if we see something that needs to be done, then we recommend the change be done upstream and then OpenShift pull it down.
Right. So now you say you're using the Apache license. I agree with you that the Apache license gives you the rights to integrate. The Apache Software Foundation gets its contributors to sign what's actually a contributor agreement that attests to their ownership of the code. You decided not to do any of that sort of Apache contributor, CLA kind of stuff.
Yeah, we decided our lawyers looked through it very carefully and decided that wasn't necessary. And a contributor agreement is a big stumbling block to get contributions, especially little bug fixes or individual contributors or contributors who need to fix something as part of their job. Is getting a license agreement and a contributor agreement all of a sudden involves lawyers and signatures and fax machines, and you're not going to do that for a small fix, and you're not going to contribute it back if you've made a local change that you're using. But without the contributor agreement, just issue a pull request on Git, and that's all there is to it.
Right. So are you going to be taking this insight back to Apache? Because it sounds like a great piece of wisdom to get rid of CLAs. I agree with you completely about them, by the way.
I have suggested this myself to people at the Apache Software Foundation. Whether they take our advice to heart or not, I don't know.
Right. And then the other gotcha for cloud services is the terms of use. What are your terms of use like? I know that's a very hard question to answer in a sentence, but are you taking co-ownership of all of my applications and data, or have you been able to come up with a legal structure that leaves me in control of my own destiny when I'm using a service?
So we have a terms of use agreement, and a real fast read of it makes it sound like, Red Hat's taking my code. What are they going to do? But if you read very closely, all that we have asked is that you have to give us permission to take your code and copy it and execute it for the purpose of running the application, since your code can be copying around from various VMs to VMs and to various data centers and possibly to Red Hat machines, then back down to Amazon machines. Because the way copyright law works, you actually have to give us permission to do that. The Git push by itself doesn't necessarily mean that unless it's also written into our terms of use. You're not giving us your code. You're not giving us your secret sauce or your trade secrets or anything like that. The only thing that you give Red Hat is the right to run your code for you to run the service.
Right, right. Now, I've just been having a look around on the website. I don't see very much of an FAQ about these things. Is that because you're only expecting me to ask about them, or is it because it's a bit early in the day?
It's a bit early in the day. A bunch of that actually just came up on Hacker News yesterday, and I read through those threads very carefully, and I can see possibly a need to put some information in the FAQ and to expand stuff on our wiki about what we're actually asking for.
Yeah, yeah. I you know, as somebody who's launched open source projects like of this magnitude before, I strongly recommend a really big FAQ and taking every question that you get asked like this and answering it very transparently, because it's easy for people to very quickly get the wrong end of the stick and then start beating you with the end that ought to be in your favor. So I really recommend you do that.
I actually wrote most of the FAQ that's there right now with input from other people at Red Hat and our own engineers. And, you know, I've read FAQs and used FAQs for years and years and never realized how hard they are to write until I started writing my own.
Great.
Very cool. First off, I just wanted to say it's not a frequently asked question until it's asked at least two or three times. So while Simon may be right in taking every question and putting it in there, you know, it's like, I remember we created a news group a long time ago and somebody said, what's the FAQ for this group? And somebody said, well, we haven't even had any questions. So how can we have a FAQ for this group already? So it was pretty funny.
There's some projects that have what they call frequently unasked questions.
Yes. And you have to be careful when you review that. Yes. When you breathe that, you got to be careful. What is this actually running on? I heard you mention Amazon a couple of times. Are you actually outsourcing the actual CPUs to Amazon?
That's right. The hosted service runs on Amazon Web Services right now. And yes, we have to pay Amazon for that, and then we're giving the service away for free, so we're just eating that as a marketing expense right now. Hopefully, as our charging model gets refined and works and workable, that will start paying for that expense. But yeah, Red Hat's not in the business of running data centers, and it's not really even in the business of running infrastructure systems. Amazon Web Services does a very good job of that, and so we're letting them do that. And then as the other infrastructure providers come up with OpenStack or other-based systems, that's the business they're in, and we're going to be happy to use them for running OpenShift.
Is the infrastructure for flying it on Amazon and spinning it up there, is that part of OpenShift, or is that some secret sauce that you're going to keep back in the cobwebs?
It's one of those things where we're working on exactly how to open it up. It's a great deal of our back end on OpenShift for interfacing to Amazon Web Services is manual. It doesn't auto-scale. It's what we do is we look at the load on OpenShift, and as we see more nodes needed, a engineer sits down and spins another one up and attaches it to the OpenShift cluster. Auto-scaling is one of those things that looks very simple, and then the edge cases will eat you alive.
Exactly. You're obviously not going to be able to open source an engineer. you can't download an engineer with a pull request.
not just yet. So we've open sourced what is necessary to run a OpenShift cluster, but is auto-scaling, since we don't do that ourselves, that's not something we can open source yet.
Now, there are other platforms that seem to have solved at least some part of that problem. Are you going to be looking at other solutions and seeing how they do it?
We will be looking at the way everybody does it.
That's really great. It's so funny to have so many people in this space all heading at the same direction, all trying to solve very similar problems, because they're problems that have plagued us, not plagued us necessarily, but problems that really haven't had good open solutions over the last 10 years or so as we've really rolled out what it means to be a website and stuff. So
the reaction I had when I first encountered platform as a service is a sense of incredulity, as why were not we doing this 15 years ago? We could have built PaaS's using is CVS on top of early web servers, but no one had the idea of doing that. The thing that makes me feel a little bit better about it is I'd gone through myself, my own career, many companies that had set up automated build systems. Every company had their own automated build and test system that were too tightly integrated with the way their own application was built and too tightly integrated with the way they were their build process and their check-in process and their project. It took many engineers writing these things over and over again before someone sat down and just abstracted out what was needed to set up Jenkins or BuildBot. The same thing is true with platform as a service. We, as an industry, have been doing this over and over again for 15 years, and finally, we have enough engineers who are both open source developers and have stood up enough web servers that they can automate away the boring bits.
And in fact, you mentioned build systems. One of the diagrams I saw earlier as I was researching today for this show involved a pathway that went through Jenkins. Can you describe how that would work?
So we have a Jenkins cartridge, which does something kind of slick. Jenkins is heavy enough it runs in its own gear. When you add Jenkins to your application, what happens is when you do the push, your application doesn't immediately deploy. Instead, the Jenkins gear runs through all the test cases for your application, and if they all pass, your application deploys. And if it doesn't, you get a... an error show up on a different URL where your Jenkins is at, and your application keeps running with the old version. This keeps you from accidentally breaking your live application with a thoughtless push.
Oh man, that's so cool! in fact, you know, here at my primary client, we're actually developing something that sort of looks like that. Although it's still sort of a semi-manual process, we shove stuff from Git directly into Jenkins, and Jenkins then sends the nastygram if it breaks and also shows up something on the website for it. But the deployment process past that is still manual. You know, so once the Jenkins package is all built and then that's folded into the main branch, then the main branch stuff gets pushed manually. But it sounds like you've got a much better solution for that.
Oh, we like this solution. I've done Jenkins the way you described it as well. I'm involved in several other open source projects that use Jenkins as their test system to the point where if it doesn't pass, it has to pass Jenkins before it gets merged to trunk. But that whole process is still very manual. Someone has to push it to the branch that Jenkins looks at, tell Jenkins to look at it, then look at all of the green balls, and then manually push it to trunk. Is automating that makes the process go much faster.
Well, we've at least automated like the second step of that so that as people are pushing to the project repo, those are automatically being fetched by Jenkins and built. So you don't have to push some button on Jenkins for that. That's actually handled by a Git post receive hook followed by a RabbitMQ queue in the middle, and then Jenkins is watching that managed being on the other side. So that at least these guys here have got at least that part of it figured out. Right, there wasn't a question, right? I guess I'm supposed to ask a question instead of just finishing with a statement and then going, well, it's your turn to talk now. How long have I been doing this show? How much do I know about interviewing people? Let's see. Sometimes it's just a little crazy here. All right. So let me see if there's any other important things I've left out so far. Actually, are there any questions we haven't asked yet that you want to make sure we cover before we finish up?
Let's see. There's unimportant questions, like what language is it written in? It is for the most part written in Ruby, and it's actually described in our FAQ. Why is it written in Ruby? And the short answer is that our engineers who first started the project were very comfortable with Ruby, and it's a nice condensed terse language for describing the sorts of things that PaaS's need to do. Mm-hmm. Some of the other code is actually written in shell script, not because we're a fan of shell script, but because a lot of the cartridge stuff is actually just ordinary Unix exec stuff, and the quickest way to get Unix exec stuff is hashbang bash scripts.
Actually, I was going to ask, so how does this look at the infrastructure level? When you're saying gear, are you actually just talking about a VM?
So a VM is we divide up a VM or a running image up into several dozen to several hundred gears. It'd be very, very simple to use one VM per gear, but also very wasteful. So we have instead discovered that if we use SE Linux and PAM namespaces and Linux containers, we can actually isolate applications very lightweight without the heavyweight overhead of a virtual machine, and we can run many dozens to many hundreds of web applications on one large virtual machine image. It's the thing that's really kind of happening here is that we've discovered as an industry that we're actually very, very bad at assigning workloads to machines. when you're running applications on real hardware, we would end up with one or two machines in the data center that were severely bottlenecked and everything else was running cool. So the idea of virtualizing everything is now we can move the workloads around and have the machines have more evenly loaded. But it turns out that we're still not good enough to get it quite right. We end up with a couple of dozen to a couple of hundred machines running hundreds to thousands of VM images, each of which are idle most of the time. So if we can pack a couple of dozen to a couple of hundred actually running applications, each one in a gear into a virtual machine, then we can increase the workload much more. The ideal ultimately is to have all the machines in the data center running red hot And so PaaSes such as OpenShift are a way to be more efficient utilizers of hardware.
Now, you mentioned something that I'm not really familiar with, and probably some of our audience isn't either. What's a Linux container?
A Linux container is a lightweight set of APIs that Linux has, and as Red Hat, they're available as part of Red Hat Enterprise Linux. They're available also in other Linux distributions because they're now a standard part of the Linux kernel that let a you declare an application to only be able to see what you as the controller of the container allow it to see. The at the kernel level, it clips out your view of other processes, of other sockets, of other parts of the file system. It's just it's similar to a Chroot jail, but done better and more efficiently.
Probably more like a FreeBSD jail then, because they do that sort of, you know, limiting to process IDs that belong in a certain cluster and limiting to certain sockets that belong to that jail as well.
I believe they're actually semantically almost identical.
Oh, cool, good. Yeah, because I'm familiar with the FreeBSD jail, so great. So basically, your gear is one of these containers then?
Yes.
Okay, that makes sense then. Would it ever have to be migrated, or would you just simply start new instances and finish old instances?
I think what it does right now is that they migrate as needed. If a gear hasn't been used for a while, it's spun down into a much more low CPU utilization mode, and when we spin it up again, we could, in fact, just freeze it entirely and bring it up on a new VM. And you, as the as a user or as the developer, would have a hard time telling, other than the fact that one part of your application will have paused for a moment.
Very cool. Okay, this sounds like fun. It sounds like I want to start playing with it. You say it's in developer mode or developer preview now. Is there a timeline framework for this in terms of when this will sort of move into a little more stable and commercial viable?
There's a bunch of discussion inside Red Hat for what that timeline will be, and different teams and groups have different ideas. The best I can say is as soon as we can without going too soon.
Okay. Now, Randall just said that he wants to play with it. How do I play with this thing? Can I run it in VirtualBox?
You can, in fact, run it on VirtualBox. If you go to the OpenShift.com website and then go down into the community pages, you can download a live CD image, and that will just boot and run inside VirtualBox.
Okay, and that's going to work out okay. You know, I shouldn't go out and buy a machine for it. It's not going to be so big and chunky that it's not going to work on my laptop.
I run a couple of them on my MacBook Pro. In fact, I believe I have one running right now while I have Skype running to talk to you guys.
It doesn't seem to be too great a server load then. And what else am I going to need to get it running? Is it just going to work out of the box, or am I going to need to go and get a degree in shell scripts to be able to get it spun up?
It should work just out of the box. You boot the live CD image, and it starts up a instance of OpenShift on your laptop that you can connect to. You may have to start playing some games with network connectivity and the way you've configured VirtualBox so this applications on your laptop can actually talk to the images running inside VirtualBox. But if you've played with VirtualBox, you know how to do that.
Right. And does it have its own Git instance inside the live CD, or will I need to separately run a Git instance on my machine?
It has its own Git instance inside the live CD.
Right,
it's
right.
All entirely self-contained.
So just drop it in, tell VirtualBox it's there, press the big red button, and everything's. I'm now running WordPress or something.
Off it goes. Yep.
Right. What's it like for running big apps like WordPress? Is it a familiar experience in terms of administering the thing?
It's a very familiar experience. In fact, it's often easier than just running WordPress by itself. We have up on GitHub what we call quick starts for a bunch of different applications already ready to go for OpenShift. You go to github.com/OpenShift and then search for WordPress. There's the WordPress Git quick start. You take an OpenShift application that you've already created and you create a remote to point into GitHub, pull that application in and push it back up to OpenShift, and now there's a WordPress instance for you to play with. You don't even need to install WordPress yourself.
Wow. This sounds way too easy. Earlier you mentioned that that there wasn't yet a gear for Nagios, but is now on the first item on your to-do list, which I appreciate. If I wanted to create my own gear using the templates you've provided, would I have to wait for you guys to do a pull request, or could I upload that somehow and use it with my instance?
Right now, you'd have to wait for us to do the merge. I can see you're not the first person to need that, and I've made notes of it myself. Is we've been talking about ways of having cartridges be pluggable into a live running system. And that's something we'd like to have. But right now, for the our hosted service to have your own cartridge type, you just have to wait for us to merge it in. If you really, really need that cartridge type, you can add it to your own running instance of OpenShift, either that you're running inside your own VirtualBox or that you're running up on AWS.
So there's all you need. You just need a cartridge that is a virtual machine, so I could just plug my virtual machine inside your virtual machine.
This is getting horribly recursive suddenly.
Yes, I'd like an OpenShift cartridge, please. That's just being silly. I'm sorry, but that just the odd thought comes to mind for doing that. I asked the Amazon question already. I think I'll just shut up now and ask the normal couple of questions. As long as we've covered just about everything else, we are just about running out of time. So what's your favorite text editor?
Emacs.
Yay. How long have you been an Emacs user?
Since the Emacs 18 first came out. And I actually lag a little bit. I prefer Emacs 21 to any of the ones that have come afterwards. For a long time, Emacs was my... I tried for about 6 months having it be my login shell, and that got a little bit too weird. But for a very long time, it was my mail and news reader, and I've used it as a web browser as well as my development environment.
Very cool. Very cool. I converted from VI to Emacs back in the early days because our local admin decided that the RN news reader was consuming too much of our work time. So he niced it. He put it behind a binary that only ran nice. And I realized that Emacs, if I used it as text editor, it also had the old GNews built in. GNews, not the mono one, the GNEUS, GNews.
Oh, okay.
And I started using that to read my news. And you can't nice the whole editor. It would tear up everybody else's actual productive time. So it was a great way to sneak behind the scenes and be able to read news during the day. So that's how I got it into Emacs. Back in the day. And also the your favorite scripting language?
It depends on how much I'm writing. If I need to just bang out a couple of dozen lines, it's still Perl. If it's a couple of dozen pages, I'll be using Python. And I'm in the process right now of learning Ruby just because I have to know Ruby to play with OpenShift, and it's also useful to be just always learning a new language.
Absolutely, because you know I'm some sort of polyglot. I speak something like 45 computer languages over the years, and I still haven't got my head completely around either Python or Ruby. But I have a feeling I'm going to be forced into both of those over the next few years. So, as much as Perl as I simply love to do, it's certainly becoming more useful to know also Ruby and Python for a lot of other things out there. Well, Mark, it's been really fun chatting with you. Is there any last words you want to say before we wrap up?
I would recommend everyone go to openshift.com and sign up and give it a try. Thank you very much.
Very cool. Thanks, Mark, for being on the show. That was Mark Atwood, who is the chief honcho of the OpenShift project at Red Hat. Simon, what do you think?
I think that sounds very interesting indeed as an overall application platform. Whenever I've looked at running up test clouds on my machines at home, there's been always so much housekeeping and looking after things just to get to the point where you're standing on the ground ready to start that it's been quite discouraging. And OpenShift
let us do that work for you.
The voice of the guy we sent away already. Thanks, Mark.
OpenShift sounds like it takes away all of the pre-work and gets me to a place where I can actually simply hack code and have things running really fast. So I think it sounds very exciting and very promising. The only areas where I would have any concerns at all is on the show a few weeks ago, we had a guy from Red Hat talking about Delta Cloud. And the thing that he was saying was about the political competition he had from other industry players who stopped Delta Cloud becoming a standard. And the only obstacles I can see to this being really useful for people are political ones. And this seems self-contained enough really not to need the blessing of any of the big dinosaurs of the computer industry.
You know, it's also interesting because I've been watching here at my primary client, I'll say Media Temp at least once in the show just so they get a tag for it. The primary thing that they've been working on is the next generation cloud service, or not really cloud service, the next generation grid service. And I think they've actually publicly announced it. Oh, I hope I'm not pre-announcing it. Oh, well, I'm sorry. Sorry, guys. But it's very similar to this. I mean, it's like, you know, here's your container. Here's some applications that we can assign in to add to your project. And here's MySQL backend over here. And it's very close to this. And it seems funny that, you know, if OpenShift had been available, say, 2 years ago or a year ago when this first started being developed here, you could have saved, you know, at least some half dozen man years in developing this stuff. This also means that I think you're going to see a lot more with stuff like OpenShift out there. You're going to see a lot more competition, a lot more smaller players being able to spin up quicker. So my primary client here needs to be concerned about that, I'm sure.
Yes. Yeah. It's actually interesting you say that about how you wish you had it 2 years ago. I struggle to find any negative point to make, which I'm sure makes Mark very happy. The only thing that I wish is that they had been open source sooner so that it was possible for the community to be involved and see the thing coming and to participate from sooner. Because, you know, just as you at your unnamed primary client are developing the same thing, I'm pretty sure that there are other people out there who are developing things that look remarkably like this in the sort of companies that do leading-edge work, like Wall Street banks. And if it had been open source sooner, we would have seen a community able to form and the thing coming to the market more completely formed. And I wish more companies would see that open source is their friend and not their enemy or their disruptor. But overall, this all looks really good to me. You know, I intend to get that live CD and try spinning it up. Probably not on my laptop, actually, but I'll run it up on my test server and see how it looks in VirtualBox there.
Yes, and the other thing here is that because OpenShift is the entire platform, I think the differentiator is going to be what particular gears you can run in the particular hosting environment. Because if you can't just upload gears, then you know what my client might offer running this might be different from what somebody down the street would offer in terms of running this, in terms of, and also the level of support that they provide. So like maybe there are 100 different gears here and they're all supported by email and phone service, but maybe somebody else has 200 gears, so that would be the differentiator on price and performance levels.
Yeah. Well, it'd be very interesting to see what market forms around this. I think that the idea of just writing vanilla apps rather than using some funky API and having to know... Do you remember the good old days of computing where you had to know how it all worked in order to write a program for it?
Yeah.
This seems like the step out of that world for cloud. You know, I no longer have to worry about using some funky API that's platform specific. I can now just write straightforward apps that run on Linux. And this seems like good news to me.
Simple, definitely. I mean, this is basically virtualizing the entire LAMP stack instead of just virtualizing the Linux part of the LAMP stack, which is very, very cool. So speaking of very cool, we have a number of cool projects on the shortlist coming up soon. Let me find my notes here. Okay, so next week we're going to be talking to a representative of the Gentoo project, which is, speaking of compiling from source, Well, it's a Linux from source. I'll compile everything all the time kind of guy. So, well, that's probably overstated what they do, but that's the thing I always know about when I talk about Gentoo. Week following that, we've got the representative of the Apache Software Foundation, so maybe we can actually raise a couple of the issues that came up today with him. LiveVert, which is virtual virtualization, actually having the API that is independent of whether you're running in Xen or KVM or VirtualBox or whatever. LibreOffice coming back in, or will be coming. We had to reschedule that show, but they'll be talking about their fork of the OpenOffice software and how it's affecting all the world. And finally on the currently scheduled list, we have Excito, which is a home media center. So that company is based around a model where they're actually physically selling you a box, but all the software that runs on the box to be a home media server is also open source and has community contributions. So we'll talk about that model. I'll be starting scheduling for Q3 coming up this weekend. So we should start having some new names on the list. If there's somebody that you want on the list for Q3, please contact the project leader and have them email me, merlin@stonehenge.com. And I will be happy to put them on the short list to get on the Q3 bookings. You can see our current list by going to twit.tv/floss, which is the homepage for this show. And from there, there's a link to my half of my spreadsheet, which I use actually to manage the show with. So you can see all the upcoming shows as well. You can follow us at Floss Weekly on Google+. If you search for that, you'll find us. I try to announce all the new things that are being added right there. We also have a Floss Weekly Identica and a Floss Weekly Twitter handle, which I announce short things there as well. We took a few questions today from the live chat. We tape this show at 9:30 a.m. Wednesdays. And if you go to live.twit.tv during that time, you can actually watch us behind the scenes, make all the mistakes so they get edited out, of course, and also be in the chat room and talk to us about things you might want to ask the guest. You can follow me personally at Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, on Twitter and Identica. And also I am Randall L. Schwartz on Google+. I'm posting about 5 or 6 interesting things there a day. So if you like being entertained throughout the day, that's good. If you follow me on that, you'll find out that I'm going to be in New York City from the 24th to 26th of May. We're setting up a meetup. I believe it'll be Thursday night. It might be Friday night. I haven't been in New York City for more than a day since 9/11. So it's kind of nice to actually be there for 4 days straight, which would be kind of fun. And I'll be in Madison, Wisconsin for the YAPSE North America. That's yet another pro conference from June 12th to 16th. And I'll be looking for people to meet up with there if you happen to be somewhere in the center of the United States or somewhere within close driving. Okay. So anyway, Simon, that seems to be all the plugs I want. What do you want to plug today?
So I'm actually in California at the moment. I spoke at an event at PayPal last night. Upcoming appearances, I'm speaking at the Open Storage Summit in Amsterdam on next Thursday. That's the 24th, I think. And I'm also then taking June off from travel and speaking at OSCON after that. I hope lots of the listeners and viewers for Floss Weekly will make it along to OSCON. It's the anchor conference for the North American open source community, and I would love to see you all there. If you'd like to read what I'm writing, my own website is webmink.com, and on there you'll see links to the other places that I write. I write on Fridays on InfoWorld in the US. I write on Tuesdays or Wednesdays in ComputerWorld UK. And I'm posting regularly on Google+, on Twitter, and occasionally on Identica, usually under the handle of WebMink.
Very cool, Simon. Yes, I'll be there with you at OSCON. In fact, I'm still hoping that we can do the typical live show there during our slot. Because it's right during the opening keynote, so it's always a bad time to pick for trying to get some sort of guest there. But if you're there and I'm there, we could probably count on doing a show together.
Yeah, I think we could probably do that. And I remember a couple of years back, we started grabbing people and doing shorter interviews at that show. Maybe we can have a go at doing that again this year.
Absolutely. So just stay tuned at home, guys, and you'll figure out what we actually end up doing at OSCON. That's probably the right way to say that. Simon, once again, thanks for your insight and your views in interviewing our guest, and thanks for being a co-host on the show.
Absolutely. My pleasure as ever. I look forward to joining you again in a couple of weeks' time.
Very good, very good. Well, that's about it for this week's show. So tune in next week when we'll be talking about Gentoo. So let's wrap this up and say we'll see you again next time on Floss Weekly.